Well, hey, welcome to each of you. This is Dave Krueger. I look forward to our collaboration. You may have seen the email that I sent out, and I want to reiterate a couple of questions right now if some of you have an immediate response. For this seminar series, and I'll ask if you would manage the background noise to be on, because there's a large number of people, if you would mute star 6 until you're ready to talk and then unmute star 6 again so that we manage the background. I'll go on lecture mode for in about 10 minutes or so, but I'll preserve some time for discussion at the end. So I just want to mention about the background noise because I want to preserve time at the beginning of the for discussion, for your ideas, for any clarifications and questions you have. The two questions. What is the if let me ask it a different way. If we were to sit down right now, face to face, what's the most important question you have about this topic of wellness? And secondly, after our four seminars, if you walk away saying this is one of the best seminar series you've ever attended, what would you walk away with? Anyone want to and thank you for the responses I've received. Anyone want to additionally respond right now to either or both of those questions? A most important question that you have about this topic.
Yeah. This is Rob, Mr. Krueger.
Yes, I'll talk to you if you call me Dave.
Okay, Dave.
All right, go ahead.
I would like to just learn how to. I'm an employee development and wellness manager at my company, and so I would like to learn how to basically train other people within my workplace to be wellness coaches, so that I have a team of people who are doing this for the employees of our company. And so, what I would like most to walk away with is that knowing that I have the skills and kind of the framework to be able to do that, to sit down with 4 to 6 people and kind of go over what I've learned and hopefully begin to see them take this and run with it for our company.
Okay, Rob, are these coaches already and you want fitness, wellness?
I'm sorry, Dave, I didn't hear you.
Are these coaches already, trained coaches, and you want to mentor them about how to apply this to wellness concepts and applications?
No, they're not. They're people who definitely take wellness seriously in their own lives. That I've worked with the same company for 28 years, and so
okay.
Folks that I've identified, and so basically be able to willingness and have the tools to kind of sit across the table from somebody and kind of just guide them and work individually.
Okay, what is their, just in a very succinct way, Rob? What is their training?
Oh, I don't know that they've had any day.
Okay.
Other than
what,
they've gone.
What is their title at the company?
They're different. Some are in marketing. Some are in patient care. So they're in different departments of the company.
Okay. Well, let me keep that in mind. Thank you for that. That's a challenging beginning, but I'll definitely keep that in mind. Thank you. Thank you for that. Other responses to either of those questions. The most important thing you'd like to know about this topic, and what would you like to walk away with for seminars now? Anyone? Go ahead. Would you identify yourself first and then go ahead, please?
Hi, this is Bonnie Johnson.
Welcome. Hey, go ahead.
If we were to sit down, what is wellness? How do we define that?
Okay. We're going to be looking at that in our very first seminar. It's a great question, a simple question, and the answer is complex, but I want to emphasize to you as coaches, as you know, we have to learn the basic foundation of good speaking and good writing is clarity, brevity, simplicity, and humanity. That what we know now from neuroscience is that someone will really get and retain up to 10 words when we talk or when we ask a question. So if we're really succinct, somebody's going to get it. Think about your own experience. Somebody talks a little bit long or elaborates a little bit much, you begin to wane in your crispness of focus. You may even begin to think about what you're going to have for dinner tonight. So the questions we ask or the sentences that we want to see as most powerful are a very brief, clear, succinct question. One of my buddies with whom I'm involved in some research, he is a neuroscientist in the executive MBA faculty there, Mark Waldman, has done some research to show that when people limit their comments or questions to 10 words in a situation such as emotionally charged, again, I want a management of background noise. Be on mute unless you're ready to talk so that there's no interruption. In emotionally charged situations like divorce, mediation, various situations like that, when people limit what they say to 10 words and then the other side says up to 10 words, they get a significantly more satisfying resolution and they get it in 20 to 30% of the time. So one of the things we're going to do, and this is kind of an extreme illustration to begin with, we're going to look at applying the mind and brain sciences to strategic coaching in the area especially focused on wellness, and for you to consider how this may be, if you think it will be more effective for you in doing it this way. I want to share some concepts and some systems, because when you think about changing a habit or helping someone change a habit, you don't want to focus so much on the goal but on the system. And the system is, what do you do next and what do you do after what's next? And we're going to be looking at that in terms of a scientific proven system. So for each of you, I hope you've downloaded the outline and the workbook, what I would recommend is that you do yourself the exercises and work tools in the workbook so that you'll be able to get a feel for if it's helpful to you, if you want to use, or which components of that you may want to use with clients to facilitate or catalyze their work or to illustrate something to crystallize it in their awareness. So any other questions, any other input about either of those questions? What do you most want to know, and what would you like to walk away with? Anyone? Well, think about what you do in coaching. I know those of you, and I see most of you have trained with CTA. Some of you are old buddies of mine even. What you've learned is this is a way to begin each coaching session, even a laser coaching session. You want to clarify the agenda to look at what specifically would you like to focus on, and then secondly, what would you like to walk away with, so that the client has outlined the essence of the story that will be co-created, their own goal and their own success map. And that's exactly what I've asked you to think about for this series of what you'd really like to think about and get and focus on, as well as take away. So any other questions or comments or just check-ins before I go on mute and begin the presentation component of this seminar? And remember, I'll save some time at the end for questions and comments as well. Anybody else want to chime in? Okay, we'll go on lecture mode then. Okay, and remember, these sessions are recorded. They'll be posted for playback at the link that I gave you, same place that you'll see the outline and the workbook for download. So in our first session, we'll talk about the power of story and the concept of writing a new wellness story. Now, this will parallel the introduction and the preface in the workbook. In the following three sessions, we're going to develop and apply a philosophy and model of coaching wellness that can be used with individuals and groups anywhere in the world. And I say it in that way because you don't have to be face-to-face. I work with 100% of my client, mentor coaching clients, by telephone. It works exactly as we're doing right now to do a group. So individually or group work you can do by teleconference or video conference. Now, throughout, I'm going to speak to you about your wellness story, and you'll know firsthand how to better coach a wellness story when you look at the exercises and work pages that parallel our discussion. Although we'll discuss an application to wellness, you're going to see that the principles are fundamental to all growth, change, and success. So why you? And why wellness? You're professionals who know how to listen and guide people. You are change experts and choice architects. You know that intentions need a strategy and a plan. So we're going to talk about a proven system of transformation for lasting change. The roadmap that we're going to talk about is the acronym for the 7 steps to create a new wellness story. It's a way of understanding mind and brain algorithms to deconstruct a story and to construct a revised or new one. So what's the need for wellness coaching? You've seen what I believe are some compelling statistics in the workbook preface if you've already looked at it. So here's my belief. People don't need more advice about vitamins or told again to exercise or lose weight or stop smoking. People's minds and brains don't work that way. If information were enough, we'd all be thin, we'd work out every day, we'd have a lot of money saved up for the future, we'd eat mostly vegetables. And a lot of librarians would be billionaires. But that's not how our minds work. Here is an example of the model of consultancy. every other professional except us, as professional coaches, uses a consultancy model, a looking at the problem, be giving expert advice about how to deal with it. So here's an example of that. For people who go to a physician, the physician gives expert advice, let's say in the form of a prescription. Less than 50% of those prescriptions are actually filled. Of those that are filled, less than 50% are taken as directed. So even when someone consults an expert, even when they're motivated by pain, by being scared, have to schlep across town and expose themselves to all sorts of stuff in the waiting room, less than 1 in 4 actually follow the advice of an expert. Why is that? It's not their story. It's the physician's story. It needs to become their story to own it. This is what we do when we ask at the beginning of each session, what would you like us to focus on today? The client takes ownership of the story of that collaboration. People need a clear, specific, stepwise program for change and an informed guide to help them. They need an accountability partner who's an expert at change. You don't have to be a content expert here. You don't have to have been a CEO to coach CEOs. The mission of wellness coaching is to help people establish healthier lifestyles, to write their own wellness stories, which you as coaches specialize in. In addition to individuals interested in health and longevity, who needs wellness coaching? The answer, any business interested in achieving these goals. Reducing medical claims, lowering stress, reducing absenteeism, improving morale, improving retention rates, and to generate overall savings to the organization. So, in this broad view, as a beginning, what's the scope of wellness coaching? In addition to individual and group coaching, examples of some of the portals of entry, the gatekeepers for wellness coaching, include human resource heads and groups, employee assistant programs, healthcare insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, small business owners, school systems and government agencies, especially any companies that are self-insured. Natural affiliates include fitness trainers and clubs, nutritionists, holistic care providers, health care providers, consortiums of wellness practitioners. So now let's move to the application. How are we going to do this whole thing? Why is change so difficult? In studies of coronary bypass patients, when their lives are at risk unless they adopt healthier lifestyles, and they're clearly told this just after a major coronary event in the ICU, how many do you think actually change after this life-threatening illness with information how to change? 1 in 9. It took Ignaz Semmelweis more than 20 years to persuade doctors that simply washing their hands could save the lives of mothers giving birth. He had the data, the proof, but that wasn't enough to change minds. He died before people believed in change. Changing behavior is difficult. So what keeps people from doing what they need to do for themselves? What makes change so difficult, even if someone's life depends on it? You know, a simple example. Data shows that driving while texting is more dangerous than driving while drunk. But how many people does that stop? Some of the resistance is staying in a comfort zone of the predictable and the familiar. Another component of resistance is that our brains resist change. They're programmed to operate on the default mode of repetition. So keep this question in mind. Why is change so difficult? We're going to return to it in just a moment and strategize about it. You have to own your wellness story. The light on the dashboard appears and says, Service Engine Now. you disconnect so that the light doesn't shine, it creates an artificial sense of satisfaction that nothing's needed. But another term for that is denial. Once you know something, you can never not know it again. Denial is simply a form of engagement. Even though it may be consciously invisible, you always know it's there. The symptom is a signal. It's a story in itself, a story that needs and begs to be listened to and understood. Your body will simply find another way to bring you more information. And just because you're not sick doesn't mean you're healthy. So wellness really is a mindset. This mindset gives ownership of a life story of wellness to the individual. With this ownership comes the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment. Warren Buffett used the analogy of buying a car. If you got a new car every few years, the approach would be different than if you knew you were going to choose one car and have it for the rest of your life. You'd probably do more research to know the best care for that car, probably change the oil more frequently, do everything possible for maintenance, knowing it would be the only car for the rest of your life. You'd take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you'll have for the rest of your life. Your body is irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. Everything counts. After our seminar, look at the addendum, I think it's on page 6, to see how two little French fries can weigh 40 pounds. Wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. I want to get to the question of how do you define wellness in 10 words or less. If you haven't already, I'd recommend you read The Wellness System of Energy in the preface of the workbook, beginning on page little XII, little 12. It introduces some later discussion on the impact of change on mind and brain. From the teachings of the Tao, the source of spiritual energy is physical, rooted in the base chemistry of the body. Self-cultivation refines this energy for spiritual attainment. Enlightenment is a psychophysiological achievement, a state of being rather than intellectual understanding. Spirituality is an expression of energy. So let's look now at a new wellness story. We're in a revolution in the science of wellness and of aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives than anyone in all of biological time. Now, this has taken a while because health is biologically way more complex than disease. Of 3,000 people surveyed, three activities stood out above all others as ones that prompted procrastination. Three areas people know exactly what to do and don't do it. Working out, food, and money. So more than anything else, people put off an exercise program, eating a planned healthy diet, and funding their retirement plan. What if you treated each task, such as exercise, with the same mindset as work, or coach your client to do this? With work, you don't have to get up every day and debate about whether you will or whether you want, whether you're going to take off a couple of days, or bargain with yourself to say, well, I'm going to skip it for now, but I'm going to really get with it next Tuesday. Work is there. You get up, you go to work, you don't debate it, you don't consider yourself virtuous if you decide to do it. In school, later in work, you show up. It's an organizing force, a deeply etched default mode. You go to work every day, whatever constitutes work, including full-time parenting. Now, I grew up on a farm and ranch. Every morning before school, I fed the cattle. Same every evening. It was a given. No questions asked. Age 8 on, morning, evening, 7 days a week, cattle had to eat. My dad thankfully helped make it my story because it stopped being work when some of them were my cattle. But now think about the mindset again. Exercise can be the same mindset, the default story. You need a plan, a structure, and a commitment to do it on a daily basis. We're going to return to this in some research on this. But it's just like your business. That's why people need coaches. Now, biologically, your body only knows two things, growth and decay. Dr. Henry Lodge, Jr., an internist in New York City who's devoted more than 35 years of his professional life to wellness research and has written the book, I would highly recommend it, Younger Next Year, and the companion book for women, Younger Next Year for Women. He says and has found that more than 70% of aging is not aging, but decay. Blood vessels go to every millimeter of your body and each bathe cells in either repair or inflammation. Exercise heals wounded blood vessels. Here's a quote from Lodge in Younger Next Year. Steady exercise is a coded message to your body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. Recent research at the University of Vermont showed that even moderate physical activity improves mood up to 12 hours after the activity. And Dr. Christian Werner in Hamburg summarized his institute's findings. Exercise at the molecular level has anti-aging effects. So we're going to look at the process of change in an informed and a systematic way. So first, I want to provide some context and stimulus for you to actively work on the exercises and quizzes in the workbook for each of the 7 steps of the roadmap. That roadmap is the acronym to guide and apply to a wellness story. First, let's look at the power of story. I'd like you to write down this question. What is my story? Perhaps schedule a period of time, at least 10 or 15 minutes, that is an appointment with yourself, uninterrupted, that you get in a mindset to really focus with no distractions and answer that question. Think about your story. It makes you who you are. Summarize your plot in 1 sentence. Bullet your major storylines. Now, this is not your bio, your title, your role. This is your plot. Then write this 2nd question to also reflect on during this time. What is my wellness story? If you consider making an appointment with yourself to brainstorm these 2 questions, I think it can be very useful and time well spent. So here are some premises that our work together would be based on that constitute the whole concept of what we do as coaches is to help someone develop their own story, and we're applying it here to their wellness story. 1, plot is the structure, purpose, and pattern of a story. For a life story, it's the outline of life narratives. The core assumptions of life stories inform what we look for and how we attribute meaning to what we experience. 2, we learn through stories. Stories are how we understand and how we remember. Our brains are pattern-seeking organs. We look to and need stories to both help us make sense of things, understand, and especially to remember. James Watson, the guy who discovered DNA with Crick, said, "You know, I can remember something when I fit it into a story." A story is a system for holding together facts. It makes things make sense. Defense lawyers know this. Little kids standing next to broken vases know this. Muriel Rukeyser said, "The world is made up of stories, not atoms." Think about how we try to make a story of things in order both to understand and remember. We personify the economy or the stock market as if each were a story of its own. The market held tenaciously onto its gain today. Or ascribe a story with a mind of its own to our creations. My ulcer acted up. My weight gets in the way. Or my anxiety stopped me, as if our own creation made suddenly us the victim and is the reason sufficient to not proceed. We'll come back to that. Three, we each have a personal story with a plot and storylines. Our beliefs and assumptions ghostwrite that story. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our software determines what we perceive and then how we process it. The brain needs a story, and it's going to infer one, so it's helpful to know the lexicon. Our plot consists of our core beliefs and assumptions that transform all available information into a system that makes sense. We then create life narratives according to that plot, since mind and brain are both programmed to process by the default mode and to ignore facts that contradict our assumptions. Four, a life story contains silent assumptions and emotional scripts. Our assumptions tell us what to look for as well as how to perceive and process experiences. We have to believe in order to see. Some of our beliefs and patterns may be invisible even to ourselves. George McGuire, a best-selling novelist and playwright, most recently the Broadway hit Wicked, said, "You know, I didn't even realize this at first, but there's almost no central character in any of my 24 books who doesn't have a dead mother or a lost parent." McGuire's mother died from complications during his birth. After his 23rd book, he first became conscious of this fact to say, "I recognize this now. I can't seem to start a novel unless the character doesn't have a mother. If the mother's still alive, the mother was still there. What's the problem? There's nothing to write about." Five, we believe and remember only that which fits our plot. What we expect to happen in the present reveals instantly our experiences in the past. Psychoanalysts call this transference, simply meaning we use software that was tailor-made for an earlier time and experience to process current experiences. So sometimes this means that it's a dynamite way of doing things really efficiently, but sometimes the software is outdated. That's where we come in as coaches. Someone abandoned early in life may expect more of the same in future relationships, even though the circumstances change. All subsequent information is absorbed, filtered, and organized by that narrative plot. Six, and remember, all this is in your, the basics here are in an annotated outline. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. We see what we believe. And here's the zinger. We're always right because we write the story. Here's an illustration. It's a true story out of Oxford a number of years ago. Two anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They were chosen because they had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, education, training. The two anthropologists then, after a year, not communicating at all, emerged to compare notes, and they expected essential similarities, but instead found remarkable discrepancies. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes, integrated into the colony, achieved a real harmony and unity, a comfort with the ape, got remarkable data. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony. He remained careful and vigilant, was always right on the cusp of conflict, never achieved a harmony. The anthropologists and their teams could not understand the discrepant result or find any reason. The They puzzled for months until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, carried a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it, but he knew he had it. He knew if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist who had no gun instead had a commitment. He knew from the beginning that he would either make it or not on his own. Two different belief systems. In retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, then our story tells us. 7, a story can define possibility. And you guys know this story. In centuries of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. It was impossible. In fact, there were experts at the time said that before this happened in 1954, said if anyone actually ran the mile in under 4 minutes, it would kill them. Now, Dr. Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile in 1954. Within the following 18 months, over a dozen other runners broke the 4-minute mile as well. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. Today, this is commonplace. When the mindset of what's possible changes, reality changes as well. Actually, when Bannister, who was a medical student, a resident at the time, trained on his lunch hour, when he actually crossed the finish line, when he broke the 4-minute mile, he passed out. And when someone finally helped him and revived him, his first question was, am I dead? He assumed that conventional wisdom was correct. 7, a story can define possibility, as we've just described. And that story, I think, illustrates that. So, 8, a story can also define reality. A placebo generates the effect of the accompanying story. A patient's prescribed an inert pill and some expectations, a story. In the majority of cases, the story becomes the reality. By anticipating an experience, someone can create it. In fact, the story generates a truth so powerful it can even reverse the pharmacological effect of a real medicine. The placebo is a white lie. It's a fiction that comes a truth. A recent MIT study showed that a more expensive placebo works significantly better than a much cheaper one. Same placebo, different stories. Now, this isn't what we know now. This isn't about being gullible or suggestible. For example, when a patient believes something will reduce pain, the body releases endorphins. Beliefs have epigenetic effects. Medical research suggests that up to 70% of successful non-surgical treatment are the result of the physician's belief passed on to the patient that the treatment will actually work. We're going to talk a little bit more about belief in a bit. 9, a story can take over the author. Listen to these expressions. My anger took over. My fear stopped me. A feeling, as I mentioned, that someone creates is perceived to act on its creator. Here are some ways that we can see ourselves as the victim of the stories that we create rather than the author. My doubt paralyzed me. My work eroded my free time. My weight gets in the way. Every one of these, in my view, is a coachable moment. And I have an agreement with each person I work with in mentor coaching that I can interrupt at any time so we can look specifically at what was just said when it's sort of hot off the press so that we can make use of it, and I want them to interrupt me as well, so it goes both ways. We ascribe a story with a mind of its own to our own creations. Here's another example of the power of story. A woman I know who recalled an incident from her adolescence. She attended many, many years ago an Catholic all-girls boarding school. She said, "At one party, I started a rumor that the punch was spiked, and everybody got drunk." 10. Your life is the self-statement, the manifestation of what exists inside you. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say and do is about yourself. What you say about me tells me about you. Everyone is always making self-statements. So don't take it personally. There's also a glossary in the workbook that will give you a little bit more information, especially about self-statements. You define yourself. Other people's definitions of you are more about themselves, to make themselves feel better, what they want or don't want to own, what they disavow or what they project. If you don't believe that, look at politics. That will be, I promise, the last reference I have to anything outside what we're supposed to be talking about. Number 11, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Neuroscience shows that pure facts are a myth. Quantum physics seconds the motion. This observation came originally from quantum physics and the process of observing quarks. So it's useful to look at the co-created new story focused on the client as point of reference, because that will be change-making in a way that can last for your client for the rest of their lives. And number 12, and this, listen to this, because I think this is so important. This is what we now know. An authentic belief in someone activates their brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. The most contagious thing in the world, way faster than any known virus, is a state of mind. A state of mind is highly contagious. Belief is essentially something that we can pass on. That's why I only work with clients in whom I believe, because I know then that client will teach us both why. Now, this comes from neuroscience, even though good parents have known it for centuries. So, let's return to the question about the difficulty of change. This is to kind of deconstruct some of these story components that we're talking about as a preface to looking at a system of doing that. So a couple of basic questions, and you may have these already in mind. A couple of the responses I get allude to them. Why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will someone repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder, and expect a different result, even when it leads to lower energy, or maybe debt, or plateaued careers, or disappointing relationships, or just bad health? Nassim Taleb asks in The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So, here's a two-part answer to that. Part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure. It's predictable. A comfort zone may be limiting or, in essence, uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's the default model. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out, and that can create the illusion of effectiveness. Predictability can masquerade as effectiveness. A new story generates, on the other hand, uncertainty, trepidation. And the easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. So this is what we want to think about in working with our clients to help them correctly read the uncertainty, the trepidation, the anxiety as a signpost of being in new territory, to reframe it as validation of moving ahead. Because if you read it, if you read the anxiety or uncertainty in an old model, anxiety equals danger, better head for cover, it makes sense to stop. And it immediately is effective. It immediately does end the anxiety. So, change means leaving a home base of reality, an internal map that's synonymous with identity. We tend to return to our default mode. Do a brief exercise if you don't have to hold your phone. Put your palms together in front of your face and firmly interlock your thumbs and fingers. Now, as you're holding very firmly, notice which thumb is on top. Now, keep your fingers exactly the same, firmly interlocked, but change your thumb so the other one's on top. How's that feel? Kind of awkward, kind of goofy? Now, move your thumbs back to the original position. Ah, kind of a relief. That's why people don't change. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante, add significant success or significant stress, such as a major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We're going to talk later about comfort zones and how to program change as mentor coaches. And remember, for your client, there is always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. That's the dialectic of our minds and brains. A comfort zone is simply a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process, but once established, resists change. Think of a comfort zone like a home thermostat, for example. If the temperature increases or decreases, even just a degree or two, it signals an adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and brains both automatically contribute to that. We each have a comfort zone. With our weight, we return to the familiar even if we don't like it or when it's uncomfortable. Think about you go to your favorite restaurant. You always look at all the items on the menu, but you know you're going to order the same thing. A comfort zone is predictable, automatic. We know the outcome. Think about how subtle that comfort zone can be in determining choices. The difficulty of starting a new exercise program. And remember this, a habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated. It's a collection of repetitions. If someone defines something about themselves as if it were an identity, I'm a procrastinator, I would immediately challenge that because they're treating it as if it were an identity, which is going to make it harder to change. If it's treated as a choice of this moment, it opens possibility. Now, the other part of that answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotherapist, actually, Milton Erickson, told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally, even as a kid, mischievous, he intentionally created a circuitous path, zigzags and indirect turns. And what he noticed is that each person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well-worn despite its circuitous route. He continued this, would get up early, create even more indirect and circuitous routes. Not one single person started a new, more direct route. No matter how many turns and twists, each person followed the path of least resistance. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences and then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous routes. This is why discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism. It's an actual location in the brain, located very close to the emotional center, that says, this isn't normal when we try something new. We'll talk about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. So, listen for the power of story your brain can rewire. New experiences practiced consistently form new neuronal pathways and new neural networks. And some remarkable new research shows both beliefs as well as repeating new experiences can both alter gene expression. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Metaphors and narratives actually become brain structures. Also from the Black Swan, ideas come and go, stories stay. So, I want to talk just a moment and then reserve some time for discussion about active choice, about choice architecture. This is a story that I believe illustrates choice architecture. I'm going to describe a study, unless you've read me before somewhere, and have you guess the biggest change impact of this study. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects chose a different option from polls of contrasting behavior. Lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, talk about sports, talk about business. They would choose one option and then behave accordingly for the entire day. So, for example, an introverted person would act as an extrovert for an entire day if they chose it. Additionally, twice weekly, he had them stretch to behave in a way outside their usual patterns, to eat something they had never eaten before twice a week, and to read something they had never read before twice a week. So, what do you think was the biggest change in that large group of volunteers after 4 months? The remarkable finding, remarkable to me, was that after 4 months, the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, almost all had kept the weight off. Most continued to lose weight. Now, this puzzled them initially. It wasn't a diet. It was a study focusing on change and its impact. What they found, the rationale, requiring people to change routine behavior makes them actually think about decisions rather than habitually choosing a default mode without consideration. This is what we do in coaching and call it story busting. When the participants exercised choice and became conscious that everything they did was actually a choice, everything they ate or didn't was a choice, actually most of them came to look at every bite was a choice. So they began to ask, is this bite in my best interest? Think about your last piece of cheesecake. That's not how you approached, or I approached, the last, especially with has strawberry topping, the piece of cheesecake. It wasn't, what will I be glad I've done when I wake up in the morning? It wasn't, after the first two bites, to think about, I've really gotten about 80% of the enjoyment of this entire cheesecake. What's the point of redundancy? You just keep going mindlessly. And I remember from working with you know, hundreds and hundreds of bulimics when I practiced psychiatry and psychoanalysis, it was like one bite and they were off to the races. It was all or nothing. So, once becoming aware of actively making choices, you can decide what's in your best interest, what furthers your story, and what doesn't. So, as coaches, we're choice architects to help a client be aware that a choice right now, for this moment, is the story that he or she is writing. It's not there until they choose it. And everything that someone experiences, they either create or accept. Whatever we think and feel and experience, we create each moment. So I want to conclude with some principles that focus on facilitating change. This is a preface to writing a new wellness story. And there are a dozen of these. One, each person's life story is created. In adulthood, you create whatever you think, feel, and experience. Every day is a blank page until you begin writing on it. Even though it may seem to be just the way things are, even though we have habitual default ways of doing things, we still activate those. We're going to return to that too. Two, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. That would be bite number three and beyond of that cheesecake. Three, when people create their, and I would not say that to clients, by the way, but I'm saying it to you guys. Three, when people create their own answers, they have signed on to invest in the outcome. This establishes the beginning of a sense of effectiveness and mastery. The antithesis is somebody tells you what to do. Remember the physician who prescribes and tells you what to do, tells you to lose weight, to exercise. You know you're not going to do it. We'll talk about in a later session how the brain lights up at a moment of insight, an aha moment, in three different parts of the brain to vault someone into a state of mind that's more creative, integrative, and synthetic. Consider what giving facts, information, directive, orders does on the same brain. Nothing. No part of the brain lights up. Four, change is constant and inevitable. It's the resistance to change that generates most problems. We're most successful when we learn from yesterday, anticipate tomorrow, and integrate the impact of new experience. Five, small changes lead to big changes. And we know this in coaches, as coaches, to shrink the change, to look at one step that can create a sense of effectiveness, to clarify one issue that if done today, maybe the next hour, would be progress. This focus on specific action exercises an effectiveness and initiates a model of mastery that the client is downloading while you're talking about other things. Six, problems, causes, and solutions are not always related or even interconnected. Correlation is not the same as causality. To resolve a problem, even emotionally, to come to the end of the past does not create a blueprint for success. That's why there are a lot of frustrated therapy refugees. Strategic plans for specific goals are necessary. If something's a totally new experience, you may need a guide, even for something like a healthier diet or exercise, in addition to a wellness coach. Seven, the benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what's not will become evident and self-perpetuating. Eight, you need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. Setting a goal may enhance motivation. Establishing strategies will facilitate focus. If you don't know where you're going, any map will do. So the end should be in mind from the beginning as you focus on the system. Lewis Carroll said it really well. Alice came to a fork in the road. Which road do I take, she asked. Where do you want to go? Responded the Cheshire Cat. I don't know, Alice answered. Then said the cat, it doesn't matter. Nine, you need the correct paradigm. A paradigm, also called a mindset, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. Now, the paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. With the right map, planning and strategy can make a significant difference. We each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We often are not aware of having them, but we just assume that we see things the way they are. An example here, we need to be afraid of the right thing. Smokers who are afraid of flying. Average across all participants, smoking shortens their lives by 5 years. Average across all participants, flying shortens their lives by 1 day. Or people fear someone entering their homes and committing a violent crime more than food entering their bodies that clog arteries and cause heart attack. T, 10. There are 10 rather than 12. I was mistaken. Decide what you want. Believe it's possible. A belief is a filter between reality and our perception. A belief is the mind's command to the brain, the software that drives behavior. This is what we want to understand with our clients. We now know that beliefs can actually turn genes on or off. You can change your life by changing your beliefs. Our possibilities are determined by the ones we allow ourselves to see. So, as I close, write down these three words. Belief on one line. Belief, behavior, performance. Draw an arrow from the first and the second and the second and third. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. If there's a performance that is compromised, look at the antecedent. Look at the behavior of what needs to be tweaked or adjusted. If the behavior consistently is there that's not working, look at the belief. And this is what we do as coaches, to look at the level that we can be most effective. We're in discussion mode now. If you can manage the background noise, I didn't have as much time as I'd hoped. Are there questions or comments? Remember, we're open mic now, so any questions or comments that would be helpful to discuss in the last minute or two? Any clarifications about anything that I've talked about that might be helpful?
This is Karen Powers. I signed up for your class, for the program, very last minute, so I didn't have a chance to read through all of the material that you sent. Is what you're talking about, it all correlates exactly to what you sent, the material, the workbook and everything?
Let me try to answer that. At the page you were directed to that will have the four ports for the online recording that you can play back. There's also an outline to download and a workbook. And see the correspondence of the four seminars and the outline and the corresponding components of the workbook. And I would suggest doing the exercises and work pages yourself. I think it'll make sense.
Okay, perfect. So there's two downloads, right?
Yes.
Okay, perfect.
Exactly. And I sent a reminder letter just a bit before the seminar of the download page.
Perfect.
Well,
thank you.
An offer now. If any of you have questions or comments or like to say or ask, feel free to fire an email to me. I'd love to hear an answer of those two questions from any of you who have any thoughts or any responses to that. So feel free to email me, and I'll wrap it into the discussion at the beginning of the next seminar. And I'm going to send a reminder about the background and it's an open mic format. I'll preserve some time at the beginning and the end for discussion. So thank you all very much for your attendance, energy, and all the responses that you have, especially by email. And I will. So thanks very much. We'll pick up right here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You want me to just sit this here?
Oh, yeah.